Welcome to The Wonder, exploring perspectives, rituals, and observances of modern, naturalistic, earth-revering, pagan religious paths. Here are your hosts, Yucca and Mark.
Welcome back to The Wonder. I'm Mark, one of your hosts, and today we're going to talk about The Wonder, things that make us just go, wow, this is an amazing universe, because we've been talking about some heavy topics lately, and we really want to make sure that everybody really gets that the path of non-theist paganism is about joy and the transformative, transporting mystical experience and that sense of deep and abundant happiness at just being alive. So that's what we're doing today. Once again, I'm your host, Mark.
And I'm Yucca. And I'm real excited to be back with you, Mark.
Me too. Yeah, it is a good day to podcast.
Yes. Well, let's actually jump right in. I mean, we had started to talk and then realized we really needed to hit that record button. So do we want to jump back in where we were?
Sure. Sure. We didn't record any of your short version, but that means that we get to capture your long version later on. The challenge that we posed to one another before we started recording today was to develop a top five amazing, wonderful things that we are just knocked out by in the world, in the universe. And, you know, I have to say, this kind of experience, that, oh my, wordless, overwhelmed, tearful joy experience is what told me that nature was the place of my spirituality long before I found the pagan community. I visited the rim of the Grand Canyon when I was 4. And I told everyone until I was 19 and visited it again that it was my favorite place in the world. Because I was awestruck.
Yeah.
By the staggering beauty, the unbelievable beauty, and the revelation of geology over time, this plateau rising and the river cutting into it to make this sculpture that goes on for more than 100 miles of distance and down a mile into the earth. And I was moved in a way that people talk about being moved by the spirit. And I still am by the Grand Canyon. It is a holy, holy place as far as I'm concerned. So that mystical experience is a very real thing, and I've experienced it a bunch of times in my life. And I believe that it is a part of what we're looking for as humans. When I see people that aren't seeking that at all, I see people who I feel really kind of badly for. They're living for possessions or for status or for power. And that all just seems really kind of hollow and sad and small to me. When I look out at the world, I mean, we could take up this whole podcast listing things that I think are amazing and moving. It would be easy to do, honestly.
Yeah.
But I'm going to let Yucca go first.
You're going to let me go first? Okay, well, why don't I do a few and then we'll jump back to you.
Okay, that sounds good.
So, any votes from what you know that I have on my list? No, you're going to make me choose? Okay. So I think actually the first thing that I had put down was plants and the soil food web, because we have, at least in kind of the larger Western culture, looked at plants as these inanimate objects. And we've seen them and gone, oh, so they don't move around, you know, they don't have faces like us. They're very different. Like, we kind of think of them, I guess they're kind of alive, right? They grow very slowly. But what we've been finding, and I think a lot of people, a lot of cultures have understood this on a very intuitive level for a long time, but we're now starting to understand it on a more technical level as well, is how active of organisms they really are, that how intentional they can be in shaping their communities and the ecosystem around them, that they create an entire system. We call it the rhizosphere, the area around their roots, where plants can essentially ask life, the rest of the life in the soil, the little bacteria and fungi, archaea, all of those, and say, this is what I need, right? Say that they are missing, they need some more nitrogen, or they need calcium, or any of the nutrients that they need. They release a special substance, we call them exudates. They basically make up a little cocktail of sugar that they produce from photosynthesis. So they take sunlight and turn it into the sweet liquid that they release into the soil that will feed the right organisms to come and kick off a chain reaction that eventually can get them the food that they need in the right form. Because they need minerals, right? They need the minerals that mm-hmm. are in the ground, that are present as basically dirt, right? Dead sand, silt, clay. But they can't use just, in the same way that, you know, we need iron, but we can't just eat a, you know, a chunk of iron. That's not going to do us any good. We have to have it in its heme form, or, you know, some form that we can actually use it. Plants are the same way. And there's a whole host of organisms that are, they're invisible to us because they're so tiny, but they go through this these incredible relationships that one by one, little by little, convert, you know, this little mineral here into another form. And then it builds up in the, you know, it accumulates in the protozoans' bodies, and then the fungi break them down. And so I think that that's one of the things that just is, you know, mind-blowing to me, to actually, you know, I'm looking out my window now and I'm seeing just some kind of weedy grasses out there, and knowing that underneath, where I don't see, they're in relationship with millions to literally billions of little beings in a whole world that's invisible to us.
Yes. Yes. And not just under the soil.
Oh yeah.
Where I live, we have redwood trees, which are very ancient, very primeval creatures, and they control their climate. They yep. create fog. Mm-hmm. They like to live in fog, so they create it. When it's summertime and they're too hot, they let off moisture and create fog.
Yeah.
They turn it into what they like. It's extraordinary.
Yeah. And it's been studied quite well in those forests, but it happens all over as well when we start talking about the mycorrhizal associations they have.
Yes.
This network, basically this relationship that they have with fungi that act like their trade network, like their internet, and they can send signals to each other. They can literally send care packages of nutrients to their offspring, and not just their own offspring, right? They'll send it to their literal babies, but they'll also send it to other trees, other plants in the network. They've got ones that they like and ones that they don't like, right? We start to see the different dynamics between individuals through their relationship between
tribalism.
Yes. And, you know, it's a world that we forget about, but we actually are, you know, whether we think we are or not, we're part of it, right? And we're completely dependent on all of it as well.
It's incredible. It's just incredible. And like so many of the things that are just incredible, it's going on out there all the time. All the time, like the ocean lapping at the shore, Mm-hmm. It never stops. It's this ongoing wave of life that just continues to circulate throughout the biosphere. And, you know, we kind of squirrel-like humans who are so quick and about schedules and about deadlines and about on and off. And yes, we're very, very hasty. It's true. Yes. Treebeard was not wrong. He's not wrong about that. Yeah, we don't stop enough to observe and wonder.
Yeah.
Just wonder at even the smallest things. You ever sit and watch an anthill for a couple of hours?
I love ants. They are what I truly do. I really, truly love ants.
I do too.
They are some of my favorite little beings. And I love them from just a nerding out perspective, but also just watching them do their thing.
Yeah.
And we have the real big red ones here.
So oh, I know.
They're, you know, you could even see their little faces. And
you know. Oh, that's adorable. We have the teeny tiny little Argentine ants, the invasive species ants, and they're not so cute, but it is still extraordinary just to watch them going about the business of what is able to be programmed into a brain that is almost microscopic.
Mm-hmm.
And they make choices informed by chemical information that they are fed.
Mm-hmm.
And when they are confused, they go through a confusion routine that helps them to make a decision about how to get back into the system. They're not that different from humans, really, when you think about it.
They aren't.
Nope, not so much.
And they take care of each other.
Yes.
That's one of the things that I love is the social aspect of them. And we see it too a little bit to other extent in other insects, but really their order, you know, which includes the bees and the wasps, have taken that sisterly care to a whole nother level. And when they're down in their colonies together, they're, you know, feeding each other and they're up against each other and smelling each other and, you know, grooming each other.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they're doing when they're,
mm-hmm.
when they're underneath and we don't see them.
And not always doing stuff that is functional.
Mm-hmm.
Bees, for example, they spend a lot of time just kind of eating honey and hanging out, having a good time, eating some honey, hanging out.
Yep.
It's a cool thing to observe. Okay, so that was one of your things.
That was.
And we got off onto ants and bees.
Beautiful organisms, yeah.
They are.
The many sisters. So, and, you know, I did want to come back to one thing. When you were talking about the image of the waves lapping against the shore and all of that. The thing about, for me, the being a pagan is the joy of getting to be part of that and seeing that that's us, right? We are, that's the earth, and we're a moment that the earth gets to look at itself.
Mm-hmm.
Gets to wonder about itself.
Well, that's certainly one of mine too.
Yeah.
That I am an assembly, a molecular machine that was created and that has a sense of identity and that is unique and is able to create and is able to look back at the universe and marvel. I think that may be the most profound of all lessons, mm-hmm. because it is sown with so much humility and so much glory at the same time. It's all of those things.
Yeah. So What's one from your list, Mark?
Well, I'm going to start with the waves lapping on the shore because I've got this pump in my chest that evolved to keep washing a tide over the cells of my body. And it is entirely about the tides that initially washed across echinoderms and ammonites and trilobites, who of course were a dead end.
Everything eventually is, but they, they made it for a long time.
They
How many mass extinctions did they go through?
Three, I think. Yeah, at least two. Might have been three.
Yeah.
So when I go to the ocean, which is only about 30 miles from where I live, which doesn't happen nearly as much as it should, honestly, but should is a nasty word, so we're not going to use it here. What I see with that lap on the shore and the creatures living in the tide pools and the bits of sea palm and kelp that are living there and that are being eaten by crabs and consumed by snails and, you know, providing food to salmon that are being eaten by seals and all the stuff that's happening at the coast where I live. I'm reminded that fundamentally what happened in the creation of animal organisms was the encapsulation of an artificial replication of that tide. Because we need the oxygen-rich ocean to wash across our cells. When we were single-celled organisms, we needed that oxygen-rich tide to wash across our cells. In order to become multicellular organisms, we needed that oxygen-rich tide to wash across our cells. And now here we are, trillions of cells, self-contained in this sort of bag, but still mostly water, self-aware, extending ourselves and our machines far out into the cosmos. And thinking and understanding and realizing and it is so not mundane. It is so not ordinary. It's a shame, the cynicism, the lack of enthusiasm for things like the Dragon launch this last weekend. I mean, I'm not a big capitalist, so I, you know, this whole private sector thing, I don't really care. But what I do care about is we're going up there and we're getting the long view and we're learning things. We're learning things.
Amazing things.
Yes.
Yeah.
I just feel that there's a softening in the self that happens and a humbling that happens when you realize how fundamentally simple and yet unbelievably complex and ornate and baroque and remarkable we are. Because at one simple level, we're just a pump squeezing blood across cells that need it. And that's what keeps us going. And on this other level, we are these extraordinary creatures with soaring imaginations who are able to conceive of and create so much that the universe has never seen before, to our knowledge.
At least our little corner hasn't.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's one of mine.
Wow, how to follow that up. I guess I could tie it in with the I had just written the word symbiosis down. And so symbiosis has three different forms. Most of the time when we think of symbiosis, we think of mutualism, where you know, both organisms benefit. But technically, parasite and its host, that's symbiosis as well. And commensalism.
And commensalism.
When one benefits and the other doesn't. Although, I don't know of a single example of commensalism that actually truly ends up being neutral on one behalf. Yeah, but
I agree.
Because the more we learn, the more we end up finding out that, oh, wait a second, not so simple.
Yeah, the remora actually benefit the shark. How about that?
Yeah. So the more that I learn about symbiosis, the more it challenges my own perception of this idea of self as I am me, I am this organ, I am this organism, and all my, I am a single genetic individual. Because with humans, first of all, we're eukaryotes. And when you learn about eukaryotic cells, we have mitochondria. And mitochondria probably used to be their own little organisms that came and hung out, came inside the cells of our ancestors and started living in there. Mm-hmm. And they still have their own DNA to this day that's separate, which is one of the ways that we actually track maternal lines, because you get your mitochondria from your mother and not from your father. So on that level, almost every single cell in our body, because there's a few that don't have mitochondria, but for the most part, first of all, is a composite of different genetic individuals. And now with everything that we're learning about our microbiomes, that we're ecosystems our own genetic cells are outnumbered by the cells of the millions of other billions, perhaps trillions of organisms that are living inside and on us that are carrying out functions that without them, our bodies wouldn't work. And that's just us. And every time we step out, we find that's not just the case with us, but that's the case with, you know, my cat Moose. He has that same diversity going on in him. He's an ecosystem unto himself. And so is the dandelion outside my door. And every single person listening and every multicellular organism that we know of is in this tight, tight back and forth relationship with so many others. And without each other, we aren't.
Yes. So. We're communities that declare identity. But we're not individuals.
Yeah. Well, the concept of what is an individual? Where can you say an individual starts to really fall apart?
Well, it's Russian dolls, right? It's matryoshka.
Yeah.
So it's layers within layers within layers within layers, which is kind of the way the whole universe is. So depending on the scale that you look at it, you will see something different. If you look at a human liver, you will see various commensal organisms living within the human liver, and then it performing its larger function to this larger body, right? It won't tell you anything about the personality of the person who has the liver. Whereas if you click back three or four layers and look down at a municipality, which is a society that includes the human that has the liver, you won't learn very much about the behavior of that individual either, but you'll learn a lot about the behavior of the context within which that individual operates. And it just goes on and on and on and on. 14.7 billion years, and it keeps expanding. So it's extraordinary.
And that what's going on beyond always has always captured me, that fascination of, okay,
what about the fifth dimension?
Yeah.
What about what's outside four?
Yeah.
that four is expanding into. Yeah, I'm really interested in that too.
And, you know, I don't usually use the word blessing because that kind of implies that somebody is giving something to us. But I'm very grateful to be in a time where this is something that we have some tools, at least. Who knows what tools we'll have, you know, our descendants will have, but right now that we can start to play with some of these questions, not just ask the questions, but start to investigate and test some of them.
Yes. And I will say, not to have to hammer those questions into a theistic framework because the society demands it of us.
Yeah.
That's a really important piece because Galileo didn't have that luxury. Giordano Bruno didn't have that luxury. And so the things that they posited or discovered got them into serious trouble and danger of their lives. Well, Bruno was burned to death. And Galileo was threatened with torture and then eventually went into house arrest and renounced all of what he had discovered because he wasn't willing to be tortured to death.
Copernicus before him, didn't he wait until his dying days to actually even release his book?
He
sat on it and waited and went, okay, I'm not going to do this until it's got to get out there. But
and skip forward a few centuries and Darwin did the same thing. Mm. Darwin waited till the end of his life to publish On the Origin of Species because he knew what it was going to mean. We are so much more free now, even though I look with...
And my half gets to participate.
Yes, your half gets
We're
to participate.
We're not perfect yet. You know, even someone, me born in the 80s, I still felt the struggle and still feel the struggle of against that. But at least I get to now.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Whereas there's this handful of women that were able to rise to that level throughout history until about 1960.
Yeah. And then those...
just a handful who were allowed to do that. And most of them incredibly privileged. Mary Wollstonecraft, Ada Lovelace, mm-hmm. you know, these kinds of folks
who did incredible things, but
who were such geniuses that they could not be denied.
Yeah. And were it from a privileged place in society that that we're able to, you know.
So. When I think about the number of brilliant, gifted physicists that ended up in chains and dragged to the New World to pick cotton, I just want to vomit. Because it's inevitable that brilliant people have been born to every population on Earth. Mm-hmm. People with incredible inspiration and you know, tremendous opportunity to envision things if they were just given education and a platform. And that just hasn't happened for so many people, and it's wrong.
Yeah.
But we said we were going to have an upbeat episode in which we talked about those things that we are really happy about and really love. So let's do that some more. Is it my turn?
It is your turn. I just talked a little bit about symbiosis.
I'm a big fan of symbiosis. And I hope my wife is.
Did she just come in the room?
No.
Oh, okay.
I'm just saying, you know.
Oh, because you live together. Yes.
Thing.
Two organisms living closely together. Yes.
Yes. With mutual dependence. It's, mm-hmm. you know, very much, you know, a mutualistic thing. I really want to speak to the simple magnificence of the magic of light on a leaf. Photosynthesis rocks my world. I've talked about this before, but when you think about it, everything that we are, have, experience, observe on this earth is, if not created by, then is deeply impacted by the fact that these organisms arose, which were able to take sunlight, turn it into metabolizable, metabolic.
What's the rest of the
Food.
Yes. Metabolites.
Turn it into food, metabolizable food. And that means everything. It's not just that we get to eat, you know, Quaker oats in the morning. It's the pumping of oxygen into the atmosphere so that we can breathe. It's the
ozone. The ozone layer.
Yes.
First of all, yeah.
Yes, it's the pushing away of the ozone layer and the pressure.
It allows us to live on land.
Yes, that allows us to live on land, precisely. And it's just another one of those things that I don't think people marvel at. I keep a plant on my focus, even though my room is kind of dark. I have to put my plant on my windowsill pretty frequently so that it will, you know,
give it a little meal,
remain a plant. And I do that because all the symbols that I might put on my focus, my altar, all the memories and the seashells and sea urchins and Paleolithic cave paintings and candles and memories and fossils and all the things that I might put on there, they don't mean anything if not for the simple truth of sunlight on a leaf. That is the magic that drives the world more than anything else. And when I say magic, I don't mean woo magic. I mean, wow. Like real wow magic. Sunlight hits this thing, and these cells actually take that stimulation of light and they generate sugar.
Yeah.
And the sugar becomes the food for the plant, and the plant becomes the food for the animal, and the animal becomes the food for another animal, and the big world goes all around, and the big world goes all around.
Yeah, and it's the base of all of the ecosystems that we are familiar with on a daily basis.
Yes.
Right? There's a few of the exceptions, right? We can go down to the, which are amazing all in themselves.
Black smokers, very cool. Yeah,
whoa. But everything that we interact with, all of it, Even going down into the caves, I mean, this is all coming from the photosynthesis, which, by the way,
gave us the oxygen atmosphere. And the oxygen atmosphere, this thin, tiny, delicate scrim around the world, you can see it from space. Yeah. You can see how thin and how delicate it is, how small. And all of that is what enables us to be alive,
yeah,
and have these conversations and understand ourselves as individuals and seek right living, right?
Yeah.
So that's mine, photosynthesis. Top that, yucca.
Well, I want to kind of weave back in some of the previous ones we were talking about, coming back to the symbiosis on that. So plants photosynthesize, but they weren't the first to figure it out.
No.
The chloroplasts, which are the organelles inside of their leaves that are what are doing the photosynthesizing, just like mitochondria, probably were. They've got their own DNA. They were little free living organisms that came into the ancestors of the plant cells and struck up a great relationship, a great arrangement. And then plants ran with that. And it's worked out pretty well for that entire kingdom. Yeah. But there are still many, you know, cyanobacteria and all kinds of other algae, which is a kind of catch-all term for non-plant photosynthesizers that are out there, you know, greening, filling the world with glucose and oxygen for us.
We like us some glucose and oxygen.
Yep. So, well, oof, what do I follow that up with? We could stay in a kind of biological realm, or we could kind of blast off into the surrounding space. Any thoughts there?
I like space.
You like space?
Space is amazing.
Yeah. Which, you know, we talk about space as being somehow different and far off, and, you know, you're a space cadet or sort of thing to mean that you're not connected with what's happening here. But space, what's happening in space is the larger context for our existence. Right? Yes. We got this real special little biosphere going on, but everything that's able to be happening here is happening here and exists because of the broader context, which, depending on what scale you go to, I mean, we can start with its planets orbiting a star, and its stars and galaxies and the resource cycling. Mm-hmm. It really is part of a whole cycle. The expression that we're all stardust gets kind of tossed around. But I think when you really stop to think about it, it's actually quite amazing because it's literal, right? It really, the material that makes up our bodies literally was made by the life and death of stars.
Yes. I
mean, some of it, the most of the hydrogen, some of the helium, you know, probably was a result of, you know, after the Big Bang, but everything heavier than that. So everything else on that table that you see with all of the elements, all of that comes from either being made in the belly of stars, in their death, in the collision between them, in these extremely high energy events, the scale of which is simply impossible for us to imagine with what we are aware of. And that just to get to us, to get to the little, to our little fairly low mass star and our little tiny terrestrial world, that how many generations, we don't know exactly how many generations, but more than three, probably five or so at least, stars that had to be born. So gravity pulled these immense clouds of gas and dust together that we've seen those beautiful photos that the Hubble has taken of nebula. Imagine that, those stunning colors, which the colors are based on, you know, what elements are actually in that cloud.
Yes.
And being brought together by gravity over millions of years and basically compressing into these incredibly hot, dense balls that become so hot that they can smash elements together and create sunlight, which is what's powering the photosynthesis that you were talking about. That's the smashing of elements and the process being not quite perfect. So just a little bit of energy, just a tiny bit released, but there's so much of it that it's what powers stars.
Yes.
And then it going through, depending on its mass, millions to billions of years, and dying, and then that process, that cloud left over from whether it went supernova or it sloughed off some of its material, starting again. So we on Earth were used to these cycles of nature of death, which creates the opportunity for new life. That's just part of an even larger cycle that's happening on a galactic scale. And then, oof, you start zooming out from there and you get to the scale of things like Laniakea, which is the, you know, the super cluster that our galaxy is part of. Then we're just on a completely different scale of the cycling of matter and energy.
Mm-hmm. Wow. That's amazing.
And that's us.
Yes. Yes, it is.
It is really, really us.
Yes. And it's incumbent upon us, I think, to do our best to remember how connected we are to those grander scales. You know, I was saying before we started recording, I wear rings. I have a gold wedding band, and I have a silver ring in the shape of a dragon that was made in the pattern of a Viking sword hilt that was left in a burial in a paleo in a megalithic barrow. The Vikings, when they lost a leader, they would use the megalithic barrows to bury their leaders. Mm-hmm. And so this dragon sword hilt thing is in the pattern of the hilt of that sword, but it's in silver. That's the key point. So I have this gold and I have this silver, and to understand that stars had to explode and then recohere and then explode again and then recohere and then explode again in order to regurgitate the tiny, tiny individual atoms of these super heavy materials that somehow ended up in the dust cloud that cohered into the Earth so that it could be mined and put back together into this metal that I wear decoratively. Mm-hmm. It's so humbling and it's so fun. Mm-hmm. It's so beautiful. It's just so beautiful to look at the universe in that way and understand that we are all a part of this gigantic dance that never stops. It's always functioning. It's always moving on. And we're not important. That's part of what we have to come to grips with. We're not important, but we get our time to turn on the floor as well as anybody else. And yeah.
And to love it.
And to find joy in it. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
And to find others who we can share that with and, you know, and do stuff like this. Good to
create podcasts.
Podcasts, right?
Motivate people to find the universe really cool. Okay, is it my turn again?
I think so. Yeah.
Okay.
I lost count. What are we at? In terms of numbers.
I think we're at three.
Okay.
I think you've done three, and I'm about to do three.
Okay, sounds good.
Fractal mathematics.
Hmm.
Everything is reflected in recursive mathematics around strange attractors and around chaos math. It doesn't work out into simple equations because that's not the nature of the universe. But when you see the incredible CGI that can be done now, the computer generated animation, and you see those mountains and they look so real, and you see those oceans and they look so real, and you see those trees and those ferns and they all look so real. Why? Because there are mathematical equations that can generate those patterns that are a reflection of what the universe does with matter.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that is just such a glorious thing. I am staggered by the fact that behind the physicality of all the things that we find so wonderful, there is a text of mathematics that is reflected, that reflects the rules by which matter and energy must behave. And matter and energy behaving according to laws is what I believe in. That's, as a naturalistic person, put Pagan aside for a moment, as a naturalistic person, I believe that matter and energy behaving according to physical laws is the nature of the universe. And there's nothing in the universe that isn't matter and energy behaving according to physical laws. And one of the beautiful things, and beautiful is a subjective thing that I think is kind of hardwired into us as primates.
Mm-hmm.
Because when we look at the mountains, when we look at the ocean, when we look at the trees, we're moved. We find tremendous beauty in these manifestations of fractal mathematics. But it fundamentally comes down to math. I have sat and watched a tree dancing in wind, understanding that the motion of every leaf was mathematically determined and could have been mathematically tracked based on what its starting position was and what the forces were that were placed against it. And yet what it's doing is this beautiful, extraordinary motion that fills me with joy. And I've referred to mathematics as the language of God.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't believe in gods. But if there were a God, mathematics would be the language of God.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
Everything is subject to it. And particularly when it comes to chaos mathematics, I am just floored by how readily it maps onto the physical world. So that's my number three.
Mm-hmm. How much fun it would be to go back to school for that. Wouldn't it just be delightful if that's what we could do, is just spend our time learning about all of the incredible fields?
To be honest, I'm not sure I'm smart enough to be able to handle some of those fields, but I'm fascinated by the topics. I gobble up the concepts.
Yeah. Well, you know,
that's you, number four.
I think maybe we need to save our next ones for a follow-up episode.
Really? What time are we at?
It looks like we are almost 50 minutes in.
Oh, dear.
Right? Yeah.
We should not bombard people with any more joy.
Oh, well, I think we should follow up with additional joy at a later point. I think next episode is going to be our summer solstice already.
Yes, it will. It'll be summer solstice. Hard to believe, considering that the last 3 months have encompassed 10 years. But yes, summer solstice is coming and we're going to talk about it.
And this was great.
Yeah, I know. I really enjoyed it, Yucca. Yeah. I, as always, I really have enjoyed talking with you. And there's just so much to be happy about in the universe. There really is.
Yeah. And I hope that all of you listening found found some spark of interest in there or got to share with us in our joy for a couple minutes. So
I hope so too.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Yucca.